Okay, we start with three vowels. To the Buddha. Okay, we'll start with three. a homage to the Buddha three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Now, does everybody have the sheet on dependent origination that we handed out last week? Everybody has it. Okay, so now we've been studying sutta number 38 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. And so far we did the section on consciousness on page 351. Okay, so just the point in this section is that the Buddha is arguing or contending that consciousness is always conditioned, that consciousness always arises in dependence on conditions. If you remember the way the sutta originates was when a certain monk by the name of Sati starts spreading around his understanding of the Dharma, which is that according to the Buddha, it is the same consciousness which travels around from life to life. And then, in other words, he's taking consciousness to be a kind of self or soul that moves on from one life to the next. And the Buddha says that Sati has failed to understand that consciousness is always conditioned, that there's no kind of permanent, self-existent consciousness which just goes on retaining its identity throughout one life after another life after another life. But even from moment to moment, consciousness is always different, always arising, dependent on the appropriate conditions. So we have through the eye, we have eye consciousness which sees forms, through the ear, hearing consciousness which hears sounds, through the nose, nose consciousness which smells odors, through the tongue, tongue consciousness which tastes flavors, through the body, body consciousness, which experiences bodily sensations, and through the mind, mental consciousness, which cognizes ideas. Okay, so in this way we see how from moment to moment consciousness is conditioned. Okay, now we move on to the next section in the sutta, which is called, it deals with the four kinds of nutriments. Now we're on page 352. Okay, so now the Buddha asks the monks, he says, do you see this has come to be? It's a very compressed, very concise statement, and it doesn't quite indicate clearly what is meant by this. But it seems that the monks understood what the Buddha was driving at, and they realized that what is meant by this is the entire compound of what we call the five aggregates. So what constitutes the living being, the person, actually turns out to be these five factors, five groups of factors that we call the five aggregates. What are the five aggregates? Anybody hear of them before?
Form, feeling, perception, volitional activities or fabrications, consciousness.
Right. Okay, so there's material form, feeling, perception, volitional activities or formations, and consciousness. Okay, so now the Buddha is asking, he's going to be showing now in this passage the conditionality of all the five aggregates. In the previous passage, he was showing how consciousness is conditioned. So he asked the monks, do you see this, that is this person made of the five aggregates, has come to be? And then they say, yes, Venerable Sir. And he says, do you see its origination occurs with that as nutriment? That is, it's referring to the specific factors that function as the nutriment for the five aggregates. Now in English, we use the word nutriment with the meaning, what is the usual meaning of nutriment? Yeah, a common word. Right, a food. So in Pali, the word is ahara. The word is ahara, which it comes from the verb aharati, and the verb aharati means, usually it means to bring. So somehow the noun ahara, which comes to mean food or nutriment, has implied in it the sense of bringing. Maybe that which brings up, or maybe that which sustains, you could say. So maybe sustenance would be the idea behind nutriment. So that which sustains and nourishes the five aggregates is what is called nutriment. And so the five aggregates originate with nutriment as its condition. And according to the Buddha's teachings, there are four kinds of nutriments. We've gone through this earlier, but it doesn't hurt to go through it again. So what are the four kinds of nutriments? I thought you raised your hand.
No.
Yes.
Can I answer in Chinese?
Yeah, you can say in Chinese.
Chou is saying.
You're speaking Cantonese. Not a lot.
Okay, your Mandarin is better than mine.
Okay, you can speak Cantonese. No, nobody can translate Cantonese. You can.
Well, I know what it's going to say.
Okay, try it. Try it in Cantonese. Ginsisek. I know Shishu, yeah. Maybe you better translate.
What's the second one you said? The third one is the
Yishishi. Yeah, I know what Shishu, yeah. But I can't recognize the captains. Okay, let's put them into a look. Okay, one is just, we call it solid food. Second is contact. Third is mental volition. And the fourth is consciousness. And each of these is a nutriment. The word nutriment, it's being used in the sense of a strong supporting condition, or that which sustains or nourishes something within the five aggregates. And so solid food, material food, is the nutriment for the physical body. The body, if we don't eat at least a few times a day, then the body starts to get thin. And if we don't eat at all, then the body just withers away. Okay, the second nutriment is contact. This means contact between the sense faculty and object and the mind or consciousness. And so contact is the strong condition for feeling. So it's dependent upon contact that feeling occurs. In fact, contact is really the condition for feeling, perception, and volitional activities. They all depend on contact. But of those three, usually feeling is selected as the special result of contact, because feeling is what conditions craving. And then when craving gets activated, craving is what drives the round of birth and death, or samsara. Okay, then mental volition is actually karma. And so through our volitional activities, we constantly are creating karma. And then the karma that we create becomes a strong condition. And what is this karma the special condition for? Yeah, it's the special condition for the particular mode in which rebirth takes place. And so we could say that the mental volition becomes the sustenance for the rebirth consciousness. So what is it that nourishes the rebirth consciousness? Sort of what is it that feeds into the arising of the rebirth consciousness? It's the volitional activities. And so through our volitions or our karma, the rebirth consciousness arises. And that rebirth consciousness, even though it's just like one moment of consciousness, but it inherits or it receives the entire flow of karma, of karmas that have been created in our previous lives. So all of those karmas, with all of their tendencies, just get directed into that rebirth consciousness. It's a little bit like opening up the floodgates to a dam, and then all of the water that's been backed up in the dam comes flowing, you know, down the falls, and then down into the lower part of the river. Okay, then consciousness is also a nutriment. And so what is consciousness a nutriment for? Yeah, what we call, in Pali we speak about this as name and form, or it's the whole complex of the bodily and mental factors apart from consciousness. So if there's no consciousness, then our body is just like a log. It's just a dead body. So, you know, there's no life, there's no functioning, no operation in the body. So all of the vitality in the body depends on the presence of consciousness. And then if there's no consciousness, can there be any feeling? No? If there's no consciousness, can there be perception? No. If there's no consciousness, can there be any kind of volitional activities, plans, purposes, intentions, desires? No. So all of this depends on consciousness. So then we could say that karma brings the re-arising, it nourishes the arising of consciousness, then consciousness nourishes the entire process of body and mind. So everything develops in dependence on consciousness. But consciousness in turn depends on other things. Consciousness in turn depends upon the body in our own experience. If there's no body, do we have, maybe some of you have experience of disembodied consciousness, but normally consciousness is embodied. And then whenever there's consciousness, consciousness also has to function through feeling, perception, and volitions. Without feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness can't remain on its own. Okay, so this is way these four nutriments nourish this entire complex of the five aggregates. Okay, so now the Buddha says, do you see? Now we're coming back to the sutta. Do you see its origination occurs with particular types of nutriment? So the monks say yes. Then the Buddha asks, do you see with the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation? So in other words, in order for the cessation of the five aggregates to take place, one has to stop the nourishing of the five aggregates. This doesn't mean, though, that in order to end the five aggregates, one stops eating and starves oneself to death. That was the practice that the Jains would undertake, at least some of the Jain ascetics, since they had the belief that the ideal was to subject oneself to the most extreme type of ascetic practices. And the most extreme one was to starve oneself to death. But for the Buddha, what has to be done to stop this process of nutriment is to end craving, which is, in a sense, the underlying cause of the whole process of nutriment. Okay, the rest of these sections that we have here, I'm not going to go into them in any detail, but the Buddha just is questioning the monks to make sure that they have no doubt about this, that they have seen this for themselves with proper wisdom. Until we come to paragraph 14, which is, again, it's a very important, very incisive paragraph, so it's easy to overlook. But here the Buddha says, purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession. The Pali word here is mamayati, which means literally to make it mine. Then would you understand that the Dharma has been taught as similar to a raft? That is, it is for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. And so this is referring back to a sutta that we had studied earlier, which was the sutta on the simile of the water snake, where the Buddha uses the simile of the raft to illustrate the function of the teaching. In that simile, he says that it's like a man who comes to a body of water and he wants to cross over. And so in order to get across, he builds a raft using his own hands. Then he crosses over the body of water, gets to the other side, and then what does he do with the raft if he understands the purpose of the raft? What is that? He lets it go, yeah. So the raft is just an instrument for getting across to the other shore. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, the Dharma should be seen as like a raft. It's for going across, not for clinging, not to have something to cling to. And so here, the Buddha in this sutta, he's speaking specifically about this view. We call this view of wisdom that one uses in order to understand things as they really are, to let go of them, to break through attachment through false views and craving. And so if people just take up the view and cling to the view, then they're not understanding the Dhamma correctly. And this is quite common, and I have to say, in Buddhist countries, at least from my limited experience, people have developed views about the Dharma, and then they hold, this is my view, this is the right view, your view is wrong view, your view is wrong view, and then they start arguing about one another's views. And this has gone on in Buddhist history through the centuries. But for the Buddha, the purpose of the right view, it's not to build up a kind of system of ideas, a system of thought, but to have an instrument for understanding things correctly. And then one uses that right understanding in order to cut through one's ignorance and grasping. And then once one cuts through the grasping, then one doesn't grasp to the view itself. So of course, when teaching, one will teach in accordance with that view in order to impart correct understanding to others. Okay, now we come to a passage in the sutta where the Buddha is going to connect the teaching on the four types of nutriment to the teaching of dependent origination. Actually, the teaching on the four nutriments is already dependent origination. Basically, what the teaching on the nutriments is showing is that whatever arises, arises through particular conditions. So about a week ago, somebody wrote to me. He said, when one explains dependent origination, is it necessary to explain it in terms of the 12 factors in the classical formula? He said, is it possible to explain it in 10 factors or 9 factors? And I wrote back to him and I said, if one really understands dependent origination correctly, one could reduce it simply to maybe 3 factors. Ignorance gives rise to craving. Craving gives rise to the 5 aggregates. That's the essence of dependent origination. But if one wants to specify how craving gives rise to the 5 aggregates, then one brings in from craving to grasping or clinging to karmic formations. And if one wants to explain how from the 5 aggregates one gets back to craving, then one brings out from the 5 aggregates the 6 sense bases, contact and feeling. And so the expanded 12-factored version of dependent origination can be compressed into these 3 factors: ignorance, craving, the 5 aggregates. And ignorance and craving, where are they to be found? Where?
I was going
to
say everywhere.
Craving. Craving part of volition.
Okay. Ignorance, craving, the 5 aggregates. Where are ignorance and craving to be found? It's a trick question.
5 aggregates.
Yeah. Ignorance and craving are within the 5 aggregates. But they are that part of the 5 aggregates that sort of comes out and then creates a new set of the 5 aggregates. And then in that new set of the 5 aggregates, there's ignorance and craving. They come out and create another set of the 5 aggregates. And so when one understands this, then one could see how the Buddha can say, samsara is without a first point, without a beginning. Because wherever there are the 5 aggregates, there was ignorance and craving before them. And wherever there was ignorance and craving, there were the 5 aggregates, which were due to previous ignorance and craving, which were in 5 aggregates that were due to previous ignorance and craving. And so it goes on without any first point. Okay, so now coming to paragraph 15, the Buddha says that there are these 4 kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those about to come to be. So what are the 4? I already went through them. Nutriment of physical food is nutriment, contact, mental volition, and consciousness. Okay, then the question comes, what is the source, what is the origin for the 4 kinds of nutriment? Okay, then the texts tell us these four kinds of nutriment have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. Okay, this is something of, it seems a little bit puzzling, because usually we think, why is there craving? You know, if you pass through a food stall, and in one food stall they're making pizza, another food stall they're making what do they make? Some sweet things like ice cream for sale. Another one they have candy and chocolates. Another food stall they have maybe fresh bread. And then you start smelling the different kinds of food. And then it creates a craving for food. And then if you can't resist the craving, then you go to one of the food stalls and start eating. So it seems that craving is the origin of food. And if we don't have craving for Italian food, or maybe this is a way to explain how craving becomes the origin of nutriment. Okay, people have a craving for Italian food, so then some Italian people come to the neighborhood and they open up an Italian restaurant. Then people start going to the Italian restaurant. Ah, we like the Italian food, but it gets boring after a while. Too bad we don't have a French restaurant here. Then they start talking, and then some French people hear, ah, they want a French restaurant in that neighborhood. So then they come and they open a French restaurant, and then there's French food available. Then some people think, ah, we need an ice cream parlor in this neighborhood. Where can we get a decent ice cream? So then somebody gets the idea, you know, some young entrepreneurs get the idea, ah, people say they want ice cream, so let's open up an ice cream parlor. So maybe we could say in this way, craving is the origin of nutriment. Okay, but normally I think of nutriment as being the origin of craving. But I think the way to understand how craving becomes the origin of nutriment is to think that it is craving that turns edible food, contact, mental volitional activities, and consciousness into things that nourish other things. So whether one has craving or not, one has to eat. It's one of the conditions of life is to take in food. But it is through craving that food turns into something that nourishes further craving. That sort of, the food takes on a different significance. It becomes not something simply to sustain and support life, but the food becomes an object of enjoyment, an object of indulgence. And so the food will then trigger off a kind of craving for this taste, this flavor, that flavor. Okay, similarly, as long as we live, we make contact with objects, and contact will give rise to feeling. This is the case whether it's an arahant or an ordinary person. But it is through craving that there comes a kind of thirst for certain types of contact, the contact that will give rise to pleasant feelings, the feelings that will gratify that craving. And so it's the craving that gives the contact a special significance, so that our world becomes organized into pleasant contacts, unpleasant contacts, desirable contacts, disagreeable contacts. Okay, then it's craving that turns mental volition into a nutriment or nourishment of the life process. As long as we're alive, we're always engaging in activities, and so there's always mental volitional activity going on. But it is the craving that makes that mental volition turn into karma. So it's through craving that we have volition to acquire those things we consider desirable. Through craving that we try to avoid those things we consider undesirable. And so craving becomes the condition for this whole bundle of different types of mental activity driven by greed and by hatred or aversion. And then whether there's craving or not, as long as we're alive, there's consciousness. We're always aware of something through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. But it is craving that gives a particular direction to consciousness. So it's craving that makes us direct consciousness in such a way that we become aware of those things that will satisfy our craving, and so that we can avoid those things that are repugnant to ourselves, so that we can avoid those things that we dislike. Okay, so in this way we can say that these four kinds of nutriment have craving as their source, craving is their origin. Whether there's craving or not, those four kinds of nutriments are always functioning. As long as we live, we have to eat, we make contact with objects, we engage in different activities, and we are conscious or aware. But it is craving that turns these four activities into things that nourish the process of becoming. The process of samsara. Okay, now the Buddha raises the question, where does craving arise? Craving arises from feeling. Feeling arises from contact. Contact from the six sense bases. The six sense bases from name and form, or mentality, materiality. Materiality from consciousness. Mentality, materiality from consciousness, consciousness from the volitional formations, formations from ignorance. So through craving, now the Buddha has connected the teaching on the four nutriments to dependent origination. And then in paragraph 17, he goes into dependent origination in forward order. He takes the 12 factors in forward order. And then in paragraph 18, he takes dependent origination, the 12 factors, in backwards order. And so I prefer to explain dependent origination to take it in backwards order. Now I've done this in detail with some earlier suttas, but now I'm just going to treat it briefly so that we could get an overall picture of how these 12 factors hang together. Okay, so first, the last factor in the formula is old age and death. So this is the central problem of suffering that the Buddha faced when he went on his quest for enlightenment. How do we put an end to old age and death? And then the Buddha, as he investigated, he realized that old age and death occurs. You know, usually we think, why does, you know, if you get a death certificate, the coroner has to fill out a form, and the form will say, cause of death. So, heart disease, maybe in medical terms, coronary thrombosis, or stroke, cancer, automobile accident, pneumonia. But if the coroner were a good Buddhist, cause of death, birth. Essential cause of death, birth. Incidental cause of death, that could be the cancer, heart disease, stroke, whatever. But the reason why anybody has to die, because they are born. Okay, so then he raises the question, what is the condition for birth? And then he uses an expression, it's a little bit hard to understand. The expression, birth is the condition for old age and death. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But then the question comes, what is the condition for birth? Why are we born into this world? Okay, so the statement that comes in the sutta is bhava pachaya jati, which means birth. Jati means birth, and cause or condition is pachaya, and the condition is bhava. Bhava is what is translated here as being, sometimes as existence, sometimes becoming. And so if we just see this statement, it's a little bit puzzling. What is meant by saying that being or existence is the condition for birth? It seems, you know, to common sense, it seems that birth is the condition for existence. Okay, what is meant, to understand what is meant by bhava, being or existence, the commentators explain two kinds of existence. One is called kama bhava, which means, I translate this as karmically active existence. And the other is upapatti bhava, which means rebirth existence. And so, the relationship between these two is that karmically active or karmically creative existence is what creates rebirth existence. And it is rebirth existence, upapatti bhava, is actually identical with jati. But kama bhava, that is the side of existence, the side of life in which we are creating new karma, fresh karma. And so if you pay careful attention to your experience, you could see that sometimes in our day-to-day experience, we are just sort of floating along nonchalantly, just experiencing things in the world. But then at other times, we are acting upon the world. And when we are acting in ways that are ethically or morally either positive or negative, then we are creating karma. And that is what is called kama bhava. That those occasions in our lives when we are actively creating fresh karma, new karma. And so this new karma can be unwholesome karma or wholesome karma. For example, when one practices generosity or helpfulness to others, one is creating wholesome karma. When one observes the precepts, one is creating wholesome karma. If one practices meditation, one is creating wholesome karma. If one studies the Dharma with an aim to understand, one is creating wholesome karma. If one explains Dharma to others, one is creating wholesome karma. If one does anything from the motivation of generosity, of loving kindness, of compassion, helpfulness to others, one is creating wholesome karma. But if one harms others, steals, acts in any way out of greed, hatred, and ignorance, then one is creating unwholesome karma. And so this wholesome karma and unwholesome karma, we are constantly creating, and that karma becomes accumulated within the deep layers of the mind. And then this karma is what becomes active at the time of death. And that karma gives rise or creates the new birth, the next birth. And so it's our karmic activities that direct the stream of consciousness to the new existence. Or in other words, it's karma, karmically active, karmically creative existence that determines birth. Okay, maybe we'll pause here and just I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything that I've been saying so far before we come to the next. What did you say? Two comments. The Chinese translation of the four nutriments is actually quite similar to the English. For solid food, the Chinese word means chunks or separate servings. Excuse me?
You mean in Chinese?
That's what this person says, yeah.
Dwan,
yeah, dwanshya, dwanshya. The dwan is a lump, right?
It's a period, period of time. And each period of time actually.
Oh, I see, the dwan is a period of time. Because the Pali, it's kabali karo laharo. Kabali means a lump or a ball. In Chinese, this would be, I think, kwai.
Kwai. Exactly, it's literally identical meaning. Lump it together, the something in it, lump it together, the small ball.
Yeah.
Two different translations. She's saying one, he's saying.
Yeah, maybe Dwan is the common translation. I don't know what the old translators use.
Both are common.
Both are common. Okay. Then another comment is taking craving to be demand and nutriment as being supply. Okay, that's good.
Okay.
He says craving is, you know, in economics, supply and demand. And they say that demand creates supply. So he says craving is demand. And it's the origin of nutriment, which is supply. I don't know. And then the question, what is it that grasps onto consciousness as a nutriment? It's actually the other four aggregates that take up consciousness. Okay, any questions? Please, Phil.
One thing I'm kind of grappling with is the notion of rebirth. Is it accurate to conceive of like rebirth in from moment to moment, from one moment to moment, as kind of a microcosm of rebirth from life to life? Is that
one could see it as a kind of microcosm, but I don't think it would not be really correct the way some do to interpret rebirth to mean just, you know, the arising of experience from one moment to another. But as you say, we could see it as kind of microcosm. But according to the Buddhist teachings, that there is a rebirth, which is a continuation of the life process through the flowing on of the stream of consciousness from one physical body to another physical body. But as I explained last week, what the Buddha rejects is the thesis that it's the same consciousness as a kind of persisting self that continues on. Consciousness is always changing, always arising and passing away. But the stream of consciousness doesn't come to a complete end with the death of the body, but it will go on to new forms after the body expires. Yeah.
Jati, that's birth, not rebirth, correct?
Jati just means birth.
Yeah, so they're not really talking about rebirth, they're talking about birth, because it's birth here, not rebirth. Right?
Yeah, but birth is always understood as a rebirth, but the word jati itself simply means birth.
I mean, does the Buddha in the Sutta Pitaka ever use a word for rebirth, or is he just speaking of birth whenever he gets into it?
Well, I think birth is, sometimes we have the expression puna jati. Puna jati, puna means again. It's a little bit like the English re. So puna jati is again birth.
And that's in the sutras, in some of the sutras?
I think it comes in Dhammapada. Dukkha jati puna punam.
Yeah, but Dhammapada,
wait, you're under, trying to undermine 2,400. A little dodgy.
I don't know, like in the Sutta Pitaka, do you find that?
I'd have to do a search for it. But one does have very commonly Puna Bhava. Puna Bhava means repeated existence.
Existence.
Yeah. Or repeated becoming, becoming again and again. Did you have a question? Johnny?
Like the more
okay. Any other question? Okay. Did you have a question? Okay, then we'll go on with the formula. Okay, so now the question comes up, what is the cause of karmic existence? Or what is the cause of being or existence? And then the answer that we find in the formula of dependent origination is in Pali, upadana, which means literally taking up, or translated as clinging or grasping. And so it's through our clinging or grasping that we create fresh karma. Even usually the wholesome karma can also be motivated by clinging or grasping. Because people grasp to pleasant results, then they'll engage in wholesome karma. If people are ignorant of the law of cause and effect, then they'll engage in unwholesome karma through just simple grasping. And so this grasping is the attempt to acquire, we say, material possessions, sensual pleasures, as well as grasping to views, clinging to views. Okay, so what is the condition for clinging or grasping? The condition is craving. So clinging means that one grasps what one already has. One holds on to what one has and one doesn't want to let go of it. Whereas craving means one wants to take possession of what one does not have. So craving is the desire for what one doesn't have, thinking, let that become mine. Let me get possession of that. And then clinging is the holding to what one already has. Actually, the most basic type of clinging is the clinging to the five aggregates themselves. And so we cling throughout our life, we cling to these five aggregates, and we do all types of activities, karmic activities. And then at death, this clinging is not yet finished. And so when this body no longer can support the process of consciousness, the body falls away, but that clinging is still present within consciousness, and so it grasps on to another life form. In other words, some physical organism which is just beginning to develop. And in this way, the stream of consciousness connects to that physical organism and arises again in the form of a new living being. Okay, so the condition for this clinging is craving. The craving for sense pleasures, the craving to go on experiencing, enjoying, existing in some form or another. Okay, so what is the condition for this craving? The condition is feeling. We experience feeling through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And that the pleasant feelings trigger a craving for more experience of pleasant feeling. We want to go on experiencing the same pleasures again and again. And painful feelings trigger a craving to escape from those unpleasant feelings, usually by pursuing more pleasant feelings. But sometimes if there's a lot of oppressive pain and people try to escape from it just by completely deadening their sense, their consciousness, or their sense faculties, So people use alcohol and drugs when they have a lot of problems just to escape by making the mind or consciousness almost catatonic. Okay, so feeling is the condition for craving. So what is the condition for feeling? Contact. We make contact with objects, and the contact sparks feeling. How do we make contact with objects? Through the six sense bases, which are the six sense faculties: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and then the faculty of thought or mind. Okay, how do these six sense faculties arise and develop? What is their condition? Here the text says, I actually like the Pali rather better than any translation, nama rupa. Nama rupa is often translated name and form, but nama is actually very, very similar to the English word name. They both come from the same verbal origins. But nama doesn't literally mean name, but nama is that aspect of the mind which is responsible. The way I explained it, it's that aspect of the mind which is responsible for organizing the world into a kind of systematic whole, that which assigns names and concepts to things, that which creates meaning. And so the constituents of nama are basically feeling, perception, volitional activities. And so it's through feeling that we differentiate the things in the world between what is agreeable and disagreeable. Through perception, we're able to label things, to distinguish, to assign concepts to things. And it's through our volitional activities, or our disposition towards volitional activities, that we use things and that things have purposes, applications. So it's volition that makes the world instrumental in serving our purposes. And then all of this becomes the basis for our naming activities. So that's why the mental side is called nama, name. And then the bodily or physical side of experience is rupa, or form. And so it is out, this name and form begins to take shape in the mother's womb. So when the ovum is fertilized, and when consciousness connects to the fertilized ovum, then name and form emerge together with consciousness. This means already in the embryo, there is, of course, there's the physical form, the body of the embryo, but already there is the mental activity of feeling, perception, and some volitional activity already beginning. Then as the organism is developing within the womb, the basic form or body of the organism starts to develop the sense faculties. The eye starts to emerge and take shape, the ear takes shape, the nose, the tongue, as well as the body. And then as the organism, when it emerges out into the world, then it has the six sense bases, which become the means of making contact with the objects of the world. And then through that contact arises feeling, which gives rise to craving and clinging and so on. And so the process of becoming, of existence, starts when name and form begins to coagulate or to take shape within the mother's womb. So then the question comes, arises, what is it that causes name and form to take shape within the mother's womb? Why does name and form spring up in the womb? And then the answer comes, because consciousness descends into the womb, or because consciousness arises based on the fertilized egg. And so when consciousness arises, then it turns, the fertilized egg becomes the body of the newly emerging organism. And when consciousness connects, then feeling, perception, and volitional activities arise together with it. And then this whole interplay of consciousness and name and form continues throughout the whole embryonic process, and then it continues beyond that through the whole course of life. So our whole life is an interplay of consciousness with name and form, consciousness with the form of the body, consciousness with external form, consciousness with the factors of name, feeling, perception, volitional activities. Okay, then the Buddha raises the question, what is the origin of consciousness? Why does consciousness originate again in the mother's womb? Why does consciousness spring up and begin the life process? And why does consciousness arise in a particular situation? Why is one person born, or one being born as a human being, another being reborn as an animal? Some are reborn in the heavenly worlds, the hell realms. Why does rebirth take place? And why does it take place in a particular situation? The answer the Buddha gives is because of, here it's translated formations, but now I prefer volitional activities, sankhara. Okay, the word that's translated sankhara, the Pali word is, the Pali word that's translated volitional activities is sankhara. Now sankhara, the word sankhara, it's interesting to see how it's formed. It comes from the prefix sam, which gives the sense of together, a little bit like collect or compile, bring together. And then it's based on the verb karoti, which means to do, or to act, or to make. From the verb karoti, we get the noun karma, and we also get a word kara, which means action or activity. And so sankharas are activities that go together, or activities that work together, or activities that form and construct things. And from other texts, we know that these activities are basically volitional activities or intentional activities. That is, there are actions that originate from volition, from intention. And so we are forming purposes, intentions, volitions, and through those purposes and volitions, we engage in activities. And these activities create the karma, and that karma is what brings into being the new consciousness. And so the condition for the arising of consciousness is the volitional activities that we engaged in a previous existence. And then the Buddha raises the question, what is the condition for these volitional activities? Why do our actions create karma? What is it that turns these activities into karmically potent forces? And to that question, the Buddha answers, it is ignorance. Ignorance means not knowing things as they really are, not knowing the true nature of things. And so because of this ignorance, we engage in various activities, sometimes unwholesome activities, sometimes wholesome activities. These unwholesome and wholesome activities create karma. That karma brings consciousness into a particular realm of existence in the new life. When consciousness arises, it brings along with it name and form, the body, and the other mental factors. Out of this initial name and form, there emerge the six sense bases. Through the six sense bases, we make contact with the world. This contact gives rise to feeling. The feeling creates more craving. Through the craving, we acquire things and cling to them. Through our clinging activities, we create more karma, which brings into being a new existence. And that new existence begins with birth and ends with old age and death. And so that is the way the 12 factors hang together in sequence. I'm going to deal further with them next week, but now I'll just ask. Okay, now I'll just ask whether there are any questions on anything that I've said so far.
What are the three tanhas again?
The three types of craving?
Yeah.
The craving.
In Pali.
In Pali?
Yeah.
Kama tanha.
Yeah, kama tanha.
It's craving for sense pleasures.
Right.
Bhava tanha, craving for existence.
Existence.
And vibhava tanha, the craving.
That's the one. Vibhava,
yeah.
Right, for annihilation.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay, now we'll see, there's one internet question. Are subconscious choices karma formation, since they are not intentional, but still driven by craving or aversion? I mean, the Buddhist texts don't really speak about subconscious choices, but what we would say is that, according to Buddhism, the mind occurs very, very quickly. So what, at a coarse level, we would call a subconscious, but according to the Buddhist way of looking at it, these are actually accompanied by consciousness, but they're just occurring so quickly that they don't really register very clearly on our grosser level of consciousness. You know, like you could, let's take an example, a grosser example. Somebody is a trained pianist, and so they're playing maybe a piece of music on the piano. So they're not always consciously selecting, at least it seems superficially, they're not always consciously selecting, I'm going to move from this key to that key. But they know the piece that they're playing so well. They know the piece they're playing so well that they can just go through it very quickly, and yet each note that they press is accompanied by a conscious intention. If they didn't have that intention to press this finger on that note, they couldn't get the note out of that key. Similarly, when we go, say, take a walk, we might be walking down three or four streets. We're never aware that we're lifting our foot and putting it down. Maybe I'm thinking about what I'm going to say in the lecture this morning, or I'm thinking about something that I've been working on. And so I might take a walk, complete circle around the monastery, and I've never been aware consciously, I say I'm not consciously aware of taking a single step, unless there's something like maybe a branch on the road or some uneven space on the road, then I have to pause and consciously take the step. But otherwise I'm lost in thought, but I'm walking a 20-minute walk around the monastery. But in fact, if we really examine how the mind is working, one would see that every time I take a step, there's the intention to take that step. But the intention just goes so quickly that it doesn't register on my surface consciousness. But I'm still taking that step consciously. This is why one of the exercises in meditation is to do the walking meditation, so that every step one is taking, one is doing with full awareness. Then one sees that every step, right step, left step, right step, left step, every step takes place through conscious intention. Correct? And then somebody might be sitting and doing some knitting.
This is crochet.
You call it crochet?
This is crochet.
Yeah.
Doing it, this is crochet.
And then she's listening to a lecture. And she's not paying much attention to the crochet work because she's completely absorbed in the lecture. But she knows how to do the crochet work so well It just goes automatically, so that within the space of one lecture she can knit the whole sweater or shawl.
This is just going to be a throw for a bed. Or meditation for this cold.
But if you give me the crochet needles, then instruct me how to do crochet. I have to do every one with conscious intention.
Oh yes, I taught people knitting.
And they have to do it with every.
Yeah, it's eventually it's effortless and whatever. But at first, it's really hard. And you really have to concentrate on every little bit, and every little minutia thing of how to really control. There's a lot of things, subtle things you can do with your fingers to control the thread. Eventually, you don't think about it; you just do it. But when you teach people, you want to give them the hint. It's hard because the hands don't want to do it at first.
Yeah. Okay, we will stop now for the lunch break. And I'm going to continue the sutta next week. There's a retreat here in the morning, but I think there'll be the class here in the morning. I want to encourage you to come to the retreat, but then I won't have a class.
Are you not having a class right now?
No, I want to have the class.
Do you also want us to come to the retreat?
Excuse me? I just suggested how to do this.
I'm going on a retreat.
Excuse me?
Is that the meditation retreat?
It's a 3 days called a monastic retreat. It's not just straight meditation, but there are classes as well. Okay, we'll skip next week then. We'll take the next class on the 9th.
Okay, we can have class in the library.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm just thinking if I say to people, come for the... Anyway, okay, we'll have the class in the library. If you come for the retreat, you could choose either to come for the morning talk that belongs to the retreat or to my class. Sometimes you have to have like a two ring circus.
Don't they have a class in the library also? Regular classes?
It won't be next week, because they're having that class today. Okay, and we'll send this out on the announcement that the class will be in the library. Okay, so we'll end now with the sharing of the merits, and then we'll come back after the lunch for a little discussion. Today, a fair number of people didn't come today, usually come.
They're at the other place.
Oh, really?
Because I also misunderstood. I thought you meant, last time you mentioned going to the library, and I wasn't sure whether you meant this time or the following, so I went there and I saw.
Oh, so they misunderstood then.
Or they found out more interesting.
Maybe so. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva Chirang rakantu mang param etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupicha asanya sanino tukha pamuchantu pusanto nibhutin. Okay, please stand. Okay, three short bows to the Buddha.